This month marks the 60th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision, which initiated efforts to integrate schools around the country, and especially in the American South, where black and white children received largely unequal opportunities for education. Today, vestiges of segregation still remain. In the city of Little Rock, African American communities remain largely segregated from white ones. Joining me to discuss this issue is John Kirk, chair of the History Department at University of Arkansas at Little Rock. He's also a regular contributor to KUAR. He and geography professor Jess Porter will be giving a presentation tonight on race and Little Rock neighborhoods at the Hillary Rodham Clinton Children's Library. John, welcome.
Hello.
Many Americans are aware of Little Rock's Central High Crisis in 1957, and how pivotal that event affected civil rights issues and struggles in Arkansas and around the nation. But you argue that the more decisive response to the Brown versus Board of Education decision in Little Rock had to do with housing. Could you explain what happened to Little Rock neighborhoods during the 1950s and why it was so decisive to civil rights issues in this city?
Yes, one of the things that was happening in Little Rock in the post-war era, immediate second post-war era, was a program of slum clearance and urban renewal. That is, federal money was given to clear land that was designated as slums and to build new housing, and particularly public housing, in different places across the city. And in Little Rock, as in many other places, urban renewal often became known as Negro removal. And what happened is that many places, particularly in central areas of the city, many African-American neighborhoods were leveled and many homes destroyed. And often it was controversial as to whether those were slums or not and how the African-American population felt about them. Mainly it was white planners who made those decisions. And a lot of those homes and houses were moved, particularly public housing most notably, to different parts of the city. So consciously, African-American public housing was built to the east of the city and white public housing was built to the west of the city. And those trends that were set in the 1950s continued onwards and have continued onwards to today. And they segued importantly with the school desegregation, because school desegregation was happening around the same time that these plans involving the housing were being put in place. And you can clearly see the way that the school board went about school desegregation in Little Rock mirrored those plans. That is, one of the first things that Little Rock did under Superintendent of Schools Virgil Blossom in preparing for school desegregation was to, in fact, build more segregated schools. So Blossom built Horace Mann High School and Hall High School very markedly on different sides of town. So Horace Mann, a new African-American high school, was built out in the east part of the town, and Hall High School, a predominantly white school, or exclusively white school, was built out in the west of town. And they provided kind of safety valves for desegregating Central High downtown, because that was the one school designated to desegregate in a very controlled and limited environment. And Hall High allowed white students to move out west, or who lived out west, to go to Hall High, and African-Americans to go to Horace Mann High. So you had a very limited, controlled desegregation of Central High in 1957. So you can see right from the beginning, urban renewal and slum clearance plans were intersecting hand in hand with the way that school policy was evolving at the time of Brown.
How were neighborhoods in Little Rock and schools different before the so-called urban renewal and slum clearance?
Well, from our research, we've discovered that Little Rock was a much more integrated residentially place before Brown, before the decades of Brown, than it was afterwards. Part of that is to do with the shape of the city. It was a much smaller city then. And of course, you know, you had Central High School as the city's only high school by the mid-1950s, only white high school, that is. Of course, there was a segregated Dunbar High School, which was just across the way, you know, a few blocks down from Central High. So you see a lot of integrated areas downtown, and African Americans and whites tend to live much closer to one another than they do now. There are discernible areas of African American residents downtown, but they were usually only a few blocks away from one another, white and black areas of residents. And there were many instances of so-called salt and pepper neighborhoods, that is, where African Americans and white had mixed areas of residence. And they have become much more infrequent now And certainly the kind of blocks that you see, the block patterns of residents have expanded with the city. So that rather than areas of mixed black areas of residents, white areas of residents, some black blocks, some white blocks, what you see are large tracts of Little Rock today where there's almost exclusively white residents and large tracts of the city where there's almost exclusively African-American residents. So the chances of an African-American family living next to a white family today in closer proximity are much more remote than they were in the earlier period. That is, there's more chance of African-Americans and whites living in close proximity to one another 60, 70 years ago in Little Rock than there are today. So although we've gone through an age of desegregation, of lunch counters and efforts to desegregate schools, in terms of housing policy and in terms of housing segregation, segregation has actually increased in housing rather than decreased. At the same time, it was decreasing in other areas.
At the time when this process took place, how did white community leaders in black communities respond, and how did they compare?
Well, a lot of this process, of course, happened in the 1950s when the power structure was exclusively white. It was exclusively white people who made these decisions about slum clearance, about urban renewal, about city school policy. And pretty much the African-American community had to put up with whatever was said. And they had some voice, and of course they had some restitution through the courts, but they were by and large unsuccessful in being able to challenge housing policy in the courts, and by and large unsuccessful in getting the Brown versus Board of Education decision implemented in the way that they wanted it to be implemented. So much of this decision-making process is driven exclusively by the white community. So many of those policymakers would argue that they were simply reflecting the views of the white community in that they supported segregation and they were building segregated housing and segregated schools to reflect community desire. Of course, the black opinion didn't really come into it in that context. Blacks tried to resist and tried to litigate against that, but ultimately, in the mid-1950s in particular, their political power was pretty limited and they didn't really get a chance to have much of a say in how things developed.
So what is the impact of housing discrimination on the city today?
Well, the situation in housing is really important because if you think about it, where you live determines a whole bunch of other things in your day-to-day life. So if you have large tracts of white residents or large tracts of black residents, as you do in the city today, the chances are that all the facilities in that area are going to be used by the members of that one particular race. So if you segregate a city in large tracts of housing, then, for example, playgrounds that are in those neighborhoods will be segregated. Schools that are in those neighborhoods will be segregated if you don't have any policies to counteract neighborhood schools and neighborhood residences. And all the facilities, you know, in those neighborhoods will be largely segregated. So in a sense, you know, housing segregation trumps a lot of the desegregation or works against a lot of the desegregation that happened in the 1960s onwards, because that desegregated particular facilities. But if you move the population to very different sides of the city and they live in exclusively neighborhoods of all white residents or African-American residents, then not by law, but by fact, a lot of the facilities in those areas in which people live will be, in practice, segregated and used by only members of the race who live there anyway. So in effect, you've resegregated a whole bunch of facilities by maintaining, or not maintaining, but creating a segregated, extremely segregated housing stock and housing patterns within the city.
All right. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
That was John Kirk. He's the chair of the Department of History at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and a regular contributor to KUAR. You can catch a presentation of his and Jess Porter's findings tonight at 6 o'clock at the Hillary Rodham Clinton Children's Library in Little Rock.